Group meeting, Saturday, 22nd May, 1976.
In regard to karma, you said in previous lectures that you could switch it off like an electric light. How do you remember that one of the talks you gave? You said, how do I get rid of it? I switch off the light. In other words, I gather this mind, this intense mindfulness, carries no residue, if I understood it correctly. And yet, there's glaring instances of karma which is carried by each individual, in spite of this being able to cut off with the so-called precision that you speak of. We all know that you get residues back in from the consciousness back into childhood under certain circumstances, and things which you've not been able to integrate, you suddenly find they've come back and you thought you'd forgotten instances which usually are of an unsatisfactory nature. So that I see a little contradiction here, although I haven't got it quite correctly. That's the first point. Secondly, I don't see how you can cut off karmic forces which are beyond your control, to wit, things like revenge, white nation upon nation, as we have. We could cite the Jewish problem and the Irish problem, and indeed now the Rhodesian problem. These things seem to be outside of the power of an individual to control one or the other. We just have to suffer them, but they are injustices or wrongdoings of past generations.
Right. The question resolves itself into two aspects, the personal and the communal. Society as a whole. That which is not fully worked out in the immediate present meaning now and an hour or two or a day or two, not fully worked out in the mind itself, you see, leaves an unworked out residue. If and when that comes up into consciousness again from the depths of the unconscious, you see, one gets troubled because of it. Now, if the individual pays complete attention, total attention, if he's capable of such total attention, to that which has now come up into consciousness from the hidden depths where it was stored up, you see, the unworked out karma, as we say, if he can pay total attention, in that total attentiveness, that whole complex which resides in the unconscious as if it were a tumor in the mind is completely resolved. It's completely healed. And that psychic energy is utterly purified and liberated. In that sense, you can switch it off at once. But that's with respect to that particular problem. There are so many other vasanas, they are called, the unworked out residua in the mind, you see. Each one of them sends up its own influence. If one is mindful and is concerned with the complete healing and maturing of the mind, it is the psyche, the ill psyche, which gets healed. Now, I don't see any contradiction between that with respect to any one problem And the fact that other problems which have not been worked out will, of course, later on, given the circumstance, given the stimulus, will keep coming up in the mind. See? This is where the deep aspect of introspection in the true meditative sense comes in. When one practices the real meditation, that is, letting the surface mind be completely quiet and still and peaceful, letting it be peaceful, not repressing it, not forcibly trying to keep it still, but letting it be still, in that state, it is much easier for all the vasanas, most of them or all of them, to come up into consciousness. You see? Whether they'll come in battalions or whether they'll come one by one, it just depends upon your own mind and the state you are in, the sort of stage you have actually reached. And then the whole thing gets solved, resolved immediately. Because diagnosis, complete attention, and complete healing are all simultaneous practically, where the mind is concerned. Now, is that clear? You see, this is why, one of the reasons why meditation becomes so very important. It is also important because it is related to the fact that one of the deep purposes of our individual human existence can then get fulfilled. You have often heard me say, we are the living vehicles for the inflow and outflow of transcendent energies. When the psyche is utterly healed and the mind is empty of all its clutter, then these transcendent energies continuously pour in and flow out. Provided oneself is capable of maintaining that state of complete attentiveness to the immediate now, it doesn't mean that you keep your mind empty in the sense that you prevent any stimuli from reaching you. You don't prevent anything. But you are so totally attentive to what comes into you that the energies of transcendence flow through you simultaneously, utterly purifying everything all the time, so that you are influencing the psychic atmosphere around you, unbeknown to you. You don't try to know what is happening. If you try to know what is happening, you spoil the process. Because the mind in its lesser aspect, the image-making aspect, comes into play, makes these various mental shapes, these mental constructs, you see, which are all like opaque objects obstructing the light of transcendence. This is something which has to be experienced in order to be realized. There's no sense in either believing it because it is said by somebody or in rejecting it out of hand. And also there is no sense in trying to investigate this fact with the kind of mind that one already has. Investigate in the ordinary sense of the word, which means that a person positively tries to find out for himself, uses his mind, in other words, his talking mind, which means the whole set of mental constructs he has, his conditioning, his drawbacks, his what abilities, whatever they may be, and so forth. You see? Now, this is one of the profound significances of the fulfilled yogi in life. See, if you come across a real yogi, and you just find him like this, with a vacant look on his face, don't believe that he is vacant. He is completely full of this energy of transcendence, which works in ways that are utterly closed books to us, functioning in terms of our sense observations and the ordinary discriminative intellectual processes. See? So that is the personal aspect of it. It is a long task, of course. It is a difficult task. But as and when one really sort of gets it, it comes and you say, and you know, when a thing really clarifies in the mind, you say, oh, I see. It's as simple as that. Now, in that, oh, I see, that is the external expression of having really seen. You know, like when you have to solve a problem in algebra or the business world, and you mull it round in your mind, you're perplexed and all the rest of it. And then suddenly the solution comes. And you say, oh, I see. Well, of course, it's so easy. You write it out. There it is, all perfect, 10 out of 10 sort of business. Now, there's the personal aspect. Now, with regard to the international aspect of the relationship between societies and nations and so forth, the nation is a very large animal. And he occupies a large space, and he takes a long time. The individuals composing the nation, all the nations of the world, as a whole, are quite ignorant of all these things and how they operate. They function mainly at an animal level, tinged with humanity, touched sometimes with the vision of deep things, higher things, transcendent things. But because they have just a bit of that, together with the animal, the ordinary animal drives, and a brain which plans primarily to satisfy the animal. Food, sex, commerce, in order to live, earning a living and all that. Those are the main primary things with which the ordinary individual is concerned. And naturally so, rightly so. Otherwise he couldn't survive. In order to live, he has to function as a good animal. But because of this brain which plans in terms of an awareness of life which is strongly self-oriented, you see, he is not just a good animal, but he descends into evil things, trickery, cajolery, dishonesty, brute force, and all the rest of it, conflict with his neighbor, the passion to assert self at the expense of his neighbor, I'm a better, bigger fellow than you are, and so forth and so forth. You see, all these factors come into play. The nation is composed of people of this type. You see, if you want to use the yogic symbolism, and remember it's a symbolism primarily, mankind still functions at the three lower centers, as we call them, the Mooladhara, Swadhisthana, and Manipura, food, sex, and commerce. That's his main functioning. All right. So now, the animal, this animal, the nation, being such a large animal, occupying such a large space, taking such a long time over things, the working out of the national effort, the national activity, is spread over long periods of time. In terms of the individual outlook, there is awful injustice. We pay for the sins of our fathers, and we sow the seeds of ill, that is to say, insofar as we do sow seeds of ill, we sow seeds of good also, but they don't trouble us. What troubles us is the seeds of ill. We sow seeds of ill, which have to be worked out by the third, fourth, generation, as the Bible puts it, but we could easily say the 30th, the 40th, the 300th, 400th generation. They have to be worked out. Consider just one single event in world history. Captain John Hawkins started the slave trade. It was profitable. Look what has happened in consequence. Look what the relationship between those who are descended from forebears in Africa in their interaction with the European and the white European and American peoples. Look how it is all working out. See, now it takes a long time to work out like that. These things cannot be turned off with a switch. A nation can't sit down and pay total and complete attention to the roots of illness within itself. Otherwise, how easy it would be to solve all our political and economic problems in a day. You see? So, these things happen like that. The whole nation is more or less in a state of ignorance of the deep things concerning human nature, human life, human activity, and the consequences of that activity. The nature of the consequences and the nature of the activity also is unknown. You see? So all these things produce what we do see. Is there any contradiction now? Karma works out very slowly where the nation is concerned. It works out slowly where individuals also are concerned. As long as we are ignorant and not taking ourselves in hand, in the right way.
So world karma, we can do nothing about at all, except it can be only revolutionized by the personal effort of every individual.
Exactly.
The world karma is something we have to live with. Each generation has to live with the backward actions of previous generations and do the best they can to heal the breaches.
Precisely. We have to do the best we can under the circumstances. But remember that the best we can is something far profounder and far more efficient than the thought out procedures which we say, the best thing we can do now under this situation is so and so. I've spent the last 2 days thinking about it, and this is the conclusion I've come to. Now, up to a point, one has to do that, to think it out, you see. But there is a right art in thinking things out, the best we can do. When we consider the best we can do, how do we evaluate the best? In terms of that which brings me comfort, pleasure, success, security, safety, the advancement in terms of my values, all these values of my family, my friends, my nation. But it is precisely these petty dualistic values enclosed within this awful prison house of ambivalence and duality, which have been the root forces for the world's ills as well as the individual ills. We have to get right out of it. We have to become completely human, in other words, and not remain in this subhuman state. The animal, with a vision of transcendence and with a brain that works in terms of self-oriented activities.
Yes, I see that. But whatever action you take even on a world scale, we're talking now about nations. As you say in your book, all truth is paradoxical. And whatever action we take is going to have ambivalence in that action.
It depends upon the action. Action which is the inevitable consequence the concomitant, I would say, the inevitable concomitant of true vision has no conflict in it. When one really sees the truth of a thing, there is action accompanying it. Not necessarily every time physical action. Physical action may not be necessary. You see? But it starts in the mind always. The mind is the overriding factor in this. And when I say mind, I don't mean mind in the limited sense of one's own personal psyche and mental processes, the processes we call mental, our thinking and feeling and all that sort of thing. But mind in its totality. See, mind in its totality, mind in its essential nature, is utterly pure. And it is so pure that it cannot be besmirched. Mind gets besmirched only insofar as mind manifesting through this organism, with its particular brain and ductus glands and its conditioning and all its surroundings and its history, it is this mind which can become an ill mind and be besmirched. You see, take the analogy of what we commonly call matter. Here the Buddhists were very wise in talking in terms of corporeality, mentality, instead of saying body and mind. They use the impersonal term. Corporeality means matter in its universality, isn't it? Matter in its universality gives you the finite, limited shape. Mind in its universality is some sort of unknown, mysterious energy which science hasn't yet discovered, or it can't measure it yet anyway, you see, which interacting with corporeality gives rise to the particular individual and all the innumerable phenomena associated with him. Now, if any individual, through the right discipline, grows in such a way that he is free of the limitations on his own mind and psyche, of all his condition, and the results of his own greeds and violences and fears and ambitions and all the rest of it, if he is free of that, then mind in its totality functions freely through him. Matter in its totality can't function through him, obviously, otherwise we'd be just atomized at once.
No, I'm quite happy about that, but what I'm not happy about is when you come out of the personal situation, then I don't see you can solve anything.
You can't solve anything when you come out of the personal situation. Impossible. No, you can't. You can't solve it.
So therefore, politics is a merry-go-round. Anything to do with people organizing something is a merry-go-round of conflict, isn't it?
Very true. That is why none of the great spiritual teachers of the world, the religious teachers, ever meddled with politics or economics or social organization or bringing about what is nowadays so loudly trumpeted, social justice. We use the terms, we haven't the slightest conception whatsoever of what social or justice mean. We use the word social, and I challenge anybody to tell me precisely what is the true meaning of the word social or society. Yes, sir.
Do you think it would be more manageable if the way we had evolved, we had formed smaller units than nations and had, say, 50 people in a clan? And these clans would look after themselves, and each person would harmonize more efficiently. It wouldn't move so slowly. it wouldn't be so ungainly, and perhaps it would work out better, I don't know, because it hasn't happened, but what do you think about that?
With regard to this question, and with regard to all similar questions, it seems to me that one of the most important things is for each individual to understand clearly the importance of the word optimum. Not maximum, not minimum. If any living organism grows too big, like the dinosaurs and so forth, you see, there are drawbacks. If an organism is too small, there are drawbacks. There is an optimum growth which enables all further development to take place. An optimum size, you see. Now, the world is plagued with this idea of maximum this, maximum that, and so forth. Maximum production, maximum security, and whatnot, and whatnot. This is just nonsensical. Now, with regard to societies on the small scale, it's easier in certain respects to manage societies on a small scale. But don't ask me how many people will constitute that sort of society. It depends upon the people. I mean, if you get two terrific individualists, they are too large a society. You see? If you get a million people who say, oh, don't worry me about that, just tell me what to do and we'll get on. That is quite a small society. You see? Now, the tendency of any aggregate is often, because of circumstance, because of necessity, because of aspiration, and so forth, to coalesce with another society, or for 2, 3, 20 groups to coalesce and form a large unit. Now, there are advantages in forming a large unit, but how large it should be is the $64,000 question. When you get a unit of the optimum size, then for political purposes, say, or economic purposes, that is the right unit. You know how Bismarck had the idea of the Zollverein, and that was the root source because of which all the small German states combined together and became a powerful Germany. Now you see, that economic unity of the Zollverein, out with the customs barriers between the different states and so forth, paved the way for a great German unity. And out of that arose the power of 19th century Germany. Now the trouble with raising up an example like that is this. What was this large unit animated by? What were the ambitions and the drives? After this happened, you see, and the King of Prussia was declared as the German Emperor of the Zollverein states, of the states which made up the Zollverein. Note carefully, he was very clever, old Bismarck. He called him the German Emperor. The King of Prussia became the German Emperor of all Germany. Didn't call him the Emperor of Germany. That came later. The German, meaning that he was a Teuton, that's all, in that sense. So the other small states which had joined up didn't feel that the Prince of 2.5 acres of territory was to be despised or something, whereas the German emperor who ruled over all Prussia was the big man. It was a psychological, clever little psychological stroke on Bismarck's part. But what were they animated by? It led to 1870. It led to ultimately 1914 and so forth and so forth. See? To solve that sort of thing, we always have to come back to the individual. Only the individual can be free of all those things. And the individual being free of all those things means that whilst he is the pure one, the one who lives rightly, humanly, he has to suffer for the wrongdoing of everybody else. This is absolutely unavoidable. There is very definitely a principle of vicariousness operating right through all living creatures, for the simple reason that we are interdependent with each other. We are interrelated. It is impossible to cut off this interdependence and interrelationship. If we could, we'd perish individually. So we mustn't cut it off at all. And because we are interrelated, my friend's wrongdoing or my friend getting into trouble means I too am in trouble. You see? That has to be accepted. And it is that sort of thing which shows that a man has freed himself from all the limitations of his animal ancestry and his socio-cultural conditioning, you see. He's freed himself from those limitations and he is the true human, displaying fully the human qualities. You see?
Do you mean that unless you purify yourself completely, you don't feel anybody else's emotion?
No. There is no end to purification. The process of purification is a continuous process. Now look, you don't have a bath today and say, now I'm pure, my body is pure, it will last for the rest of my days. If not your own nose, somebody else's nose will have something to say in the matter, and so forth. You see what I mean? It is something which has to be repeated again and again. Why? We are living beings, and all these are living processes. This is what we forget. This is why so easily we say, oh, I'll go through this discipline, I'll do this, that, and the other, and I shall reach nirvana, and then what? Stay on top of the pole? You'll starve to death. Nonsense. You'll just perish. The thing is a living process, and it is continuously done. It happens continuously. This is what we have to bear in mind. You see, very much like the body, which if it is moving through a fog or one of the good old, the famous old London fogs, is just covered with smut and soot and goodness knows what, you see, and you have to wash it off. Psychically too, the same thing happens. We live and move in a psychical atmosphere which is full of fog and dirt and whatnot and whatnot. So we have to cleanse our own psyche because the psychical atmosphere is like that. And they say that we religious people and yogis and such like are the impractical people. We are the only really practical people. We see facts as they are. Now, next question.
Could you tell us something about something I never understood? Non-resistance to evil.
I'm sorry.
Non-resistance to evil.
Ah. Yes, yes. You know, this, you know, the statement of Jesus, who resist not evil. What do we mean by evil? Something which is in an ill state, in an unhealthy, unwholesome state. Now, what is this something which is in an unwholesome or an unhealthy state? It is something which is alive. It is like a part of one's own body which somehow or other has got diseased, you see. Now, if I were wise, and if the techniques are known, I will not need surgery. Assuming that the techniques are known and it can be done, I will not need surgery. If I need surgery, well, then that part is gone out for good. It's destroyed out of me. It's a loss, isn't it? Supposing my arm has to be amputated. Well, that's gone forever. That's the end of it. But supposing that is not the case, then what do I do? I do that which is necessary to heal the body, to cure the disease in the true sense, not merely get rid of the symptoms. Now, it is the same with the psyche. If you come across evil, evil resides primarily in the mind, in the psyche. The evil is there. What do we mean by evil? Greed and hate and cruelty and all those things, which in the mind and psyche, which lead to cruel, hateful actions and so forth. Isn't that so? All right. So now what I have to do is so to understand the forces within myself, to pay such complete attention to them, that I see that this is evil. Now, in that case, I'm not resisting it. I'm not fighting against it. This is the important point. One is free from conflict, inner conflict, and therefore free from limitation within the prison house of duality. You transcend this by fully understanding duality. This is something which is so difficult, very hard to get hold of this. You have the duals. We'll say love, hate, kindness, cruelty. If you pay complete attention to what if I pay complete attention to what I commonly call love in me, then I will find that I'll be free of what I call love and its opposite, which I call hate, and the two together are transformed into something, a third something, which is altogether transcendent, which is real compassion. This transformation takes place, this transmutation takes place in the psyche. This is what we have to realize. And it happens by itself. If I resist the evil and say, oh, this is cruel, these are cruel things, I must not do them, I'm fighting against something in my nature which wants to do this thing. Am I not? So I'm repressing that part of my nature. But the repressing that part of my nature is the very thing that just causes all the trouble and the difficulty. So I must fully understand it. In full understanding, there is healing. Because full understanding is always accompanied by perfect compassion. Compassion is the warm aspect. Understanding is the cool aspect, the cool and the technical aspect. You see? And these two functioning together as one whole completely transform the evil into true good, a transcendent good, not just a relative good, which is in this caught up within the conflict of its opposite. So resist not evil. You don't resist, nor do you indulge it. You completely understand it. You know, if you read, for instance, the writings of the church fathers, like Clement of Alexandria and others, you will find they all taught this in some form or other, although time and again they did use phrases which are misleading phrases, like overcoming evil. These are inadequate words to use. They're not entirely wrong, but they're not wholly right either, you see. You don't overcome evil, you don't promote the good, and so forth, you see. But you so fully understand either the good, what we commonly call good, or what we commonly call evil, that the whole thing becomes utterly transmuted into something transcendent. And that is the right thing, the normal thing for us. Of course, the people of the world would simply not agree. They say, oh my goodness, what are you talking about? You're talking about a sort of a super saintship. Yes, super saintship is the normal thing for a human being. It comes as a shock to be told that. We will glibly give our intellectual assent to the statement that there is a spark of divinity in you. Ah, I've got a nice little spark of divinity in here. But you tell divinity, now look, don't interfere with my pleasures and my enjoyments and this, that, and the other. Tomorrow I'll be good. Today let me have a fling. It won't do, you know.
Amplifying that statement, of course, the Buddhist presentation is rather cold, I think, and one, I think, who looks at it, it's rather nihilistic, and this divine spark, or whatever you like, there must be something of that sort to enable us to understand the transcendence. Otherwise, I don't think we could. Is there something divine in man somewhere?
It is it is customary to hear it stated that the Buddhist presentation is cold. Now, if that were really the case, it is a very strange fact that the Buddha is known as the Lord of compassion and wisdom. I'd like to be presented with a bottle full of cold compassion. A cool head. But I never knew of a cool heart. Now, this spark of divinity, which is a theistic phrase, the spark of divinity is represented in the Buddhist teaching as the essence of mind. This is the spark of divinity. In Judaism, we have the term neshama. We have the term God in Christian, Zarathustrian, Hindu writings and teachings. The word is not important. What the word stands for, the reality that it stands for, is the important thing. What is the meaning of this spark of divinity within us? It represents a power, a potentiality within us, which, allowed to come to full manifestation, brings about the complete fruition of any individual human being. The very restricted presentation of Southern Buddhism the Hinayana, the Pali canon, appears as if it were very cold. But it isn't really, you know. If you go deeply enough into it, you will see that it is absolutely permeated through and through with compassion. Consider the teaching of the four Brahma Viharas. Suffusing yourself, your teacher, your friends, the hostile ones, your enemies, the whole world, everything with loving kindness, with compassion, with joy at their fruition and success. Not success in slaughtering 100,000 of the enemy, that is taken for granted, you see, and so forth. Now, how can we call that a cold teaching? Again and again, so many of the liberated ones, the great arahants, how did they become liberated? Whilst in the practice of the Brahma Viharas. In my first book, I have just a list of quotations from the Pali texts which show the overriding importance of love. The Buddha says, all the other things that you do to acquire merit, etc., you see, the good deeds and so forth, are not worth 1/16th part of the heart's release in overflowing metta, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, and so forth. Why would he say that? Why do you think he taught at all? Out of compassion for suffering humanity.
That's all right, but you see, I think most people in the room who attend your lectures would feel that What is all this to say in the belief that we have through a Christian heritage of a loving father and a life hereafter? Buddhism doesn't say specifically that, but takes you through the four Brahma Viharas and the other kinds of discipline, which is a very long, arduous road to find the depth of this. That, I think, is the problem that we all have. This deathless, unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, etc., is a very, very hard road for most people. Would you agree?
Well, now look, this is a very, very good point you've raised, Sydney. Have you ever looked into the details of the spiritual disciplines of the great Christian mystics and teachers? They are an equally hard road. They climb the heights of transcendence and plunge into the depths of the unknown just as much, just as completely and fully, as in the Buddhist presentation or the presentation in terms of the Upanishads and yoga and so forth. You see, it is like this, Sydney. Consider a fact which is universal to all mankind, to all living creatures. They experience hunger. That hunger has to be satisfied if the organism is to continue to live. All right? Now, how many different kinds of food and dishes are there to satisfy that hunger? So many different ways. But they all fulfill the one task of satisfying that hunger. So too, in the fruition of each individual being, the real fruition of each individual being, there are so many different ways, and it happens that every one of them is an arduous way. With hunger, apart from a difficulty in obtaining food because it is scarce, but if there's food available, it's very easy to just cook it as we please, or take it raw as we please, and chew it and enjoy it, and we continue to we satisfy the hunger and continue to live. We don't experience it as arduous. Why? This is nature's gift to us, human beings, for the continuation of the living organism, that to eat and digest and so forth is not arduous at all. Every newborn infant knows precisely how to suckle its mother's breast. How? Who taught it? Did it go through any arduous process of learning? It did it naturally. It just happens, as we say. Now, perhaps it may be the truth that what we call the arduous disciplines of the religious life, if we approach the religious life in the right way, are just as easy and natural as the moment I was born, I suckled my mother's breast. Nobody taught me. We just do it. It happens. We let it happen. But man is a peculiar creature altogether. Peculiar, he's funny peculiar. He's a funny creature altogether. And he's got caught up in this strange entanglement within his own being. You see, this partial vision drawing him towards universality, and this natural inherited drive to look after himself without considering the universal. See, these two produce the conflict where man is concerned. No other creature has this conflict. So all other creatures remain what they are. Your cleverest dolphin or monkey or whatever trainable animal there is, does it display anything like the intelligence and marvel that man displays and what man can do? No. So you see, there's a great difference. And this getting into a muddle, into a mess, was inevitable, and it had to be that way in order that the right sort of challenge may be thrown by circumstance, by fate, if you like, to man, in order to bring out his vision. All this is bringing out our vision and our understanding. And there comes the point when at last the vision is a reality. That is to say, it is no longer a mere intellectual perception, a mere philosophy, a mere poetic and imaginative presentation of a utopia and a wonderful, pleasant thing, but has become natural faculty, second nature, a matter of course. You actually will live like a god. You know, for instance, in the sayings of Pythagoras, one of the most marvelous things. And when a man, I'm giving you the gist of it, I can't quote the exact words. When a man has reached the highest ether, as they called it, you see, then he will be like an immortal god. The Greeks knew very well indeed that every single person, Pythagoras himself included, will just, of course, die like any other a Greek, you see, or any other human being in the world. What did they mean by saying that he will be like an immortal God? That liberation of the mind within himself will be so complete and perfect that his consciousness of the immediate process of life from moment to moment will be in terms of immortality, not in terms of mortality. See, this is the real meaning of immortality. Have you ever experienced it, actually? If you are totally attentive to the immediate now, you are utterly free from any sense of past or future. That means that the immediate now never ceases as an immediate now. Its shape is continuously changing because time is flowing, because an organism is growing and reaching the end of its lane and so forth. All that will be there. But you will be aware of the whole process in immortal and not in mortal terms. This is the supreme meaning of immortality. I don't know whether anybody else has ever presented this before, but even in the first book I have suggested that, and in this one I have, this second one, it's very clearly put in these terms, especially in the last few pages. The real meaning of immortality is just this.
The most important part of the whole book, I think, in my view.
The last chapter, well, it has a few good things in it. You see, this word cessation naturally gets misinterpreted. They think, oh, you come to the end of it. No, it is not the cessation of you, the living being, coming to the end of things at all. It is the cessation of the ill state, the cessation of the immaturity of the mind, the ill health of the mind. That is the cessation. That is resurrection, ascension. I say that what is called crucifixion, resurrection, ascension, they are all simultaneous in consciousness now, in the perfected Holy One. The one who knows how to attend. He has become pure attention. You know, for instance, the Upanishads particularly present the idea of Brahman as Sat Chit Ananda, and they translate it as being, consciousness, bliss. But if you take that middle word, Chit, which is translated as consciousness, usually, in fact always, I have translated it as awareness and explained it as complete attentiveness. This is the state of chit. You see, ordinarily consciousness and awareness have this sort of meaning. If I happen to be looking in that direction and I see you, rays of light reflected from your body entering my eyes, etc., and if I'm attending to the process, I say, I see Sydney. You see, I hear, see another person. Now, in total and complete attentiveness, there is no consciousness that I, once a subject, am seeing an other object. It is true that the actual seeing of the other object does take place, but I am not aware of it in terms of otherness. The separateness has disappeared. There is the complete unity. Now you will understand that statement in the Bible, not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it. Got it? You see, if there is this supreme awareness in which there is no otherness, there is no not knowing of anything and everything. Therefore not a sparrow falleth to the ground, but my Father in heaven knoweth it. Father in heaven is a phrase to represent this utterly liberated state. In that last chapter too, that saying of Jesus, all power in heaven and earth is now given unto me. In heaven, the Sahasrara chakra, and in earth, the Mooladhara. See, some of the deep significances of the yogic discipline and the yogic symbolism. All power is given unto me. Why, how, when? When both the positive and negative pranic forces combine and meet here in complete harmony, you see, then all power is there. Power, inactive, dormant power represented by earth, active power represented by heaven. All power is given unto me in heaven and earth. But if you tell the average Christian that Jesus Christ was a great yogi, you'll get bad looks. They don't like it. I have seen it in print. They frankly disregard any such suggestion that he was a yogi or a mystic. They dislike both suggestions. Otherwise they might lose their degree of D.D. Doctor of Divinity. Dull dud. Maybe nearer the mark in some cases.